Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the New Nation podcast. Thank you for being here. We've got a great little episode for you today. Before you do anything, please head to buymeacoffee.com/thenewnation. And you can literally do that. You can buy me a coffee. You can help sustain the show that we do once a week. I don't know, one coffee a week. It's fine. You can do one coffee, two coffee, three coffees. The amount of coffees are endless. So we thank you for contributing to the show. buymeacoffee.com/thenewnation. We've got an awesome guest today. I know we normally don't do the interview type podcast today, but I was able and afforded the chance of seeing this new movie called Wildcat, which is a semi biographical, almost kind of fantasy drama that I would call it, based on the life of Flannery O'Connor, who, if you haven't heard of Flannery O'Connor, she's probably one of the most prolific Catholic writers of the 20th century. She's very important to that movement. She's known for being part of the Gothic movement in the American South during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And we've got the executive producer of that movie, Wildcat, Eric Groth. And he, Okay, so, correction, Eric Groth. Okay, we'll move past it. We won't spend too much time on that. Eric Groth is the president of ODB Films and executive producer of Wildcat. And ODB Films is an award-winning, not-for-profit Catholic film company whose mission is to foster an encounter with Christ through artfully made, spiritually rich films. And since 2005, ODB has produced 250 short films, including the 60-film Video Catechism series for teens and young adults, its first feature film, Full of Grace, which received a Gabriel Award for Best Family Feature, and in partnership with Sony Pictures, Paul, Apostle of Christ, with Jim Caviezel playing Luke, I think, right? It was an awesome movie. I actually watched that about a month ago. It opened in more than 30 countries, earning $33 million plus worldwide. That is not an easy thing to do. And several accolades, including Christopher and Gabriel Awards. And in September 2020, Eric helped launch Renovo Media Group, an Iowa-based film company. And Eric, this is probably the most, I think this is the best part of Eric's bio here. He's been married to his wife, Becky, for 33 years, and they have 8 children.
It's the best part of my life, no doubt.
Eric, how did you, I can assume how you accomplished that, but 8 kids. How old is the youngest? How old is the oldest?
Yeah, Genevieve is our youngest and she is 14. And Jacob is our oldest and he is 29. So we've put boys and 2 girls in a 15-year period there.
That is, I mean, your wife is a living saint.
She is.
Much credit to Becky. Saint Becky, she will be known as.
Exactly.
So Eric, tell us a little bit, maybe about yourself, even before ODB and how you were able, I don't know if you found it or if you're just the president of ODB. Tell us a little bit of that story.
Yeah, we started it. You know, it really comes out of, I like to tell people, you know, when we talk about the journey and we've made a lot of films over the years and I, you know, I'm a filmmaker, but really I'm an evangelist, you know, God has called me to share the gospel. And it goes all the way back to my own personal experience in my parish. I had a very vibrant parish I grew up in. And the youth minister and the core team just did such a phenomenal job of engaging its young people, us, you know, in the faith and being very, you know, I'm 54. So this is back in the late 80s, right? And they were very, you know, very innovative for the 80s, you know, presenting the gospel in multimedia fashion with screens and shadow mimes and slide projectors and boom boxes with cassette tapes. And, you know, but I was enthralled by the fact that the gospel could be shared in creative ways. And the Lord really grabbed my heart. And so, you know, I had 2 paths I was going on. I was going to be I wanted to either be a minister to the young people in the Catholic space, in the Catholic church, or I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player.
Oh, wow.
I went off to college to play baseball.
Okay.
But I went to a place where I could kind of grow and learn in Christian education. And ended up getting my master's degree in counseling at Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio.
Oh, great.
After I graduated, I worked in a Catholic high school in Rockford, Illinois, taught religion, was a campus minister, and just took what I kind of had learned. And this is now the 90s, right? The early 90s. And we're doing programs for teens and we're wanting to be engaging and the technologies became more accessible. So we're making little films, you know, a little man on the street interviews of teens before we would do events. And I really saw it as a way to really engage and share messages. And And from there, I went and worked with a ministry called Cultivation Ministries. And we helped to develop youth ministry programs, help parishes build their programs. And as a part of that, we were doing rallies for teens and ended up growing that in pretty big fashion. We were doing events at the National Catholic Youth Conference, events for dioceses. I was the MC. I developed the content. And we're doing all these really creative short films, you know? And we would have constantly desperate youth workers like myself come up to us at these events after they were over, and they'd be like, "Where'd you get your films?" And we're like, "Well, we made them," you know? And then they'd ask, "Well, can we have them?" And it kind of spurred the idea of, wow, there's a void and a need for Catholic resources for the young church. And what if we did respond to that, you know? And so we just kind of dove in. We started outside the box, ODB Films, in 2005. And in the first 10 years, we made over almost 200 short films, 250 short films for Catholic teens, as you mentioned, in the front end. And that just kind of evolved. You know, I think when I look at my own journey, and, you know, when I was, you know, a 16-year-old on a confirmation retreat, and I went to reconciliation, and I came out, and I heard the Lord speak to me, not in a voice like you're hearing right now, but just internally, like saying three things. "Hey, I love you," which I had heard time and again, right? But it clicked. And he said, I did this for you. And again, I heard that message time and again, but it clicked. But the thing that he said that almost kind of scared me was, "I want your life." And I remember as a teenager going, "I don't really know what that means." I was dating who is my wife now, and I was like, "I don't want to be a priest. Is that what you're calling me to do?" And but it became very clear that, hey, you know, the gifts and the call in my life with the things that I have and I'm good at are can be used to glorify the kingdom and lead people closer to Jesus. And so from the short films, we ended up doing Full of Grace, and that led us to doing Paul. That led us to starting helping found a company in Iowa, which led us to Wildcat. And now recently, we just started a company called Sacred Art House with our writer-director from Paul and Full of Grace. And he did The Blind, which came out in the fall. And he's got Sight coming out in the spring, Andrew Hyatt. So he and I just started a company called Sacred Art House. And it's the concept is like, let's take the beautiful, the good, the true, the sacred. What does the collision of that look like with art house film?
Mm. Yeah.
And so that's the path we're going to go down. So long answer to your question. I the Lord called me pretty early on, loved on me, revealed to me, showed me, set me on the path. And my heart has always been about building kingdom, growing and living in holiness, being an example to those around. And I've just found the medium of film is just an amazing way to communicate messages, and to do it in ways where we don't have to, like, if we do it right and write the stories right, we don't have to bang a Bible over people's heads.
Yeah.
We can be very inviting and very accessible. And that's what's important to us. You know, my favorite review from our Paul film was from the Village Voice.
Oh,
and,
really?
And that one's usually pretty antagonistic toward things of faith, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the title of the article said, "It's a miracle. This atheist critic kind of likes Paul, Apostle of Christ."
That's awesome, though.
And you know, for us, like, I know we can create things that draw Catholics. I know we can be very, very friendly. And it's important, right? We got to edify the church, feed the church and feed the flock, you know. But we have this heart for, like, what about the person outside who is outside of understanding the maker, the creator, and how do we, and he's the ultimate creator, right? I mean, the only reason we can create is because he allows us to do it and gave us the ability. So how do we use that to glorify him? And I just think the transcendentals, right? The things that are beautiful, good, and true. And when we can present that, we're touching on things that are human, innately, internally. It doesn't matter if I'm a Catholic or an evangelical, right, or a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu or a Buddhist. Those things are planted in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see, I suppose, as my responsibility as a follower of Christ to help bring that alive in people.
I love that. Can you name off the top of your head some films that you love
kind
that do have, let's say, either Christian foundation, Christian undertone, but like you said, don't necessarily beat the Bible over your head. I have a couple that I love to talk about on this podcast, but are there any that sort of jump out at you?
Yeah, no, I love that question. There was a blogger who put out a quick like list in the 2010s. Mm-hmm. This was her top 10 Christian movies of the 2010s.
Yeah.
And I was like, here we go. You know, I mean, I, you know, we've been in relationship with Kingdom Story, and, you know, so you've got the Kendrick Brothers kind of films and you got the Kingdom Story kind of films, and they all serve a wonderful purpose. And again, it's, you know, talking about where we feel we're called.
Ooh, I'll preface the question, or I'll alter it a little bit. Mainstream.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
yeah.
So I was kind of prefacing that in a long way, right?
Right.
By saying, I thought she was going to go down the path of listing off all these Christian films.
Right, right.
And she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it was glorious because films are so inspiring. They can be inspiring, right? And the number one on her list is one I'll share. You'll probably check the box, was Hacksaw Ridge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would be in the top five for sure.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Hacksaw Ridge. You know, and of course, there's a man who represented the character, and there is a believer, right?
Yes. Right.
But the heroism, and, you know, so that's one that jumps at me.
What do you think about Prisoners? We talk about Prisoners a lot.
Well, you know what? I haven't seen it in a while, so I don't know if I can articulate well with you on that one.
Oh, go back and watch it. It'll blow your mind when you sort of watch it from the headspace of this being a Christian movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What else? What about you?
I say a lot. Well, there are movies like you have True Confessions with Robert De Niro and who's the guy that played the apostle, one of the best actors of probably all time,
Robert Duvall.
Robert Duvall, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, True Confessions, which is about a Catholic priest and his detective brother. I actually did a post about this, but there's Silence, obviously, which is a Catholic movie, right? But then one that I've seen recently, and there have been a couple that have been like, oh, this is actually a pro-life movie without saying it's a pro-life movie. But there's this one movie called Minari that A24 put out. I don't know if you saw that one.
I haven't seen it, but I know the filmmaker. And that's terrible that they haven't seen it. And I know the filmmaker.
Yeah, no, it's not. We're all very busy, Eric. but that one for me, because there's one character whose name is Paul, funny enough, but just embodies the sort of Christian spirit as far as being selfless, if that makes any sense.
That's right.
So go see Minari if you haven't seen it, everybody who's listening. Let's talk about now how you got close to Wildcat. Let's talk about the impetus for that, because the first time that I heard that it was even being made was because Ethan Hawke and Maya Hawke went on to Bishop Barron's show and were talking about it. And I think they were still in like the editing phase of.
We brought them to the studio in Iowa for that recording, and we were just right in the heart of the edit.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I told my wife about this. She said, you ever heard of Flannery O'Gara? She's like, yeah, we went to the same Catholic high school, but at different times. I'm five years older than her. So she's like, yeah, we had to read Flannery O'Connor in high school. I said, that was never a thing for us. I don't remember ever reading Flannery O'Connor. So the interview led me to Flannery O'Connor. So
that's
I started
awesome.
Reading her short stories, and then I watched the movie. So yeah, how did that all start for you?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Yeah, practically speaking, Renovo Media Group, the company that we founded that produced it, the Joe Goodman, who owns the IP for some of the things that are from the Flannery estate.
Mm-hmm.
So like he owns Violet Bear It Away and the rights to her prayer journal and things like that. So in 2021, he came to us and he had a letter of intent from Ethan Hawke. It said he was going to direct this film. He was looking for development monies to be able to get the script written. And he paired it with another project, which is another really good project. But at the time we were like, we're not ready to say yes to that at this point in the new development of our company. So we kind of passed on it. Well, a year later, Joe is a consummate development producer who is very, very persistent.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back and he said, hey, we have a script now. Are you guys interested in reading? Because now they were in a place where they were looking for financing and also production partnership. So we're like, absolutely, let's read. And to preface that, I knew who Flannery was.
Right.
I read A Good Man Is Hard to Find,
mm-hmm.
which most people who maybe know a little bit of Flannery have read that one or listened to her actually read it at Vanderbilt on YouTube, which is amazing.
Oh, really? I got to do that.
Check that out. Amazing. It put a whole new feel on it, hearing her read it.
Oh, I bet.
But I didn't know a lot about Flannery O'Connor, you know? I wasn't one of those persons who, I didn't know she was female. I bump into a lot of people.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah. You think she's just this, you know, old Irish guy. That's my impression anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But I didn't know a lot about her, but I was fascinated. And so we read the script. We finally got the script and we read the script. And the script was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started to go down a path. You know, long story short on that one, our studio ended up financing the film and being involved in the production. So this was this. We made that decision a year later in September 2022. There were three things that made me want to do the film,
mm-hmm.
And I'll save the most important one for me for the end. The first one was Ethan Hawke.
Yeah,
I had always been a fan. You know, we're the same age. Saw him in Dead Poets Society. He and that core and Robin Williams, and was just mm-hmm. way by that movie, you know, and followed his path, you know, as a filmmaker. I really do believe he's probably one of the greatest filmmakers of my generation, you know, my age group, and for sure, and just a prolific man of the stage, and has a real renaissance in a lot of ways now.
Oh, definitely.
Moving into directing, and he's just a phenomenal director. It was such a wonderful experience with him. So I'd always liked Ethan. So that was one thing. The second one was the Flannery factor, right? Like exploring, you know, learning a little bit more about her. As soon as we decided to do it, like you, Mike, after I just started diving into reading her short stories, reading her novels.
Mm-hmm.
But fascinated by how important this writer was, this female writer from the 50s in the Gothic South as a Catholic woman. In a very, you know, racially tense time frame in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering why has there not been a lot of, why are we the first one to do a narrative feature film? You know, but as you read her writing, you're like, oh,
that's why.
Yeah. Nobody wants to tackle that, right?
It was insane. The first story that I read was, I forget the name of it, but it was about the guy who's in New York City with his daughter.
Yeah,
and he's seeing the different tenants in her apartment building, and within like the first page and a half, I'm saying to myself, "Oh God, did she actually wrote this down?" And this is how they talked. But I mean, that was reality. That was reality back then. That was how people talked back then. But
that's
yeah.
right. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And we were, and I'll tell you my third reason.
Mm-hmm.
We can get to further questions about the realities, but the thing that attracted me the most was you had a dad and a daughter doing something together.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was super cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, and getting to know them over the last couple of years and getting to know Maya. And it was just a wonderful thing. At the end, our last day of filming, Maya came up to me and she gave me a big hug. And she just looked at me. She said, thank you. Like, thank you for giving me this chance to do this with my dad.
That's awesome. You know?
And it was, you know, as a man who loved family is priority number one for me, and seeing them and watching them work together, you know, and Maya started reading Flannery when she was 15. It was actually her idea. Her mm-hmm. dad will tell you, I work for her. She hired me.
Yeah.
You know, and it was her idea. And, to see that, to watch Ethan on set direct the core, but then to see how he engaged Maya. It was just mm-hmm. beautiful to watch, you know?
Yeah.
And it really became quite a wonderful family thing. Ethan's wife, Ryan Hawke, Maya's stepmom, beautiful, beautiful woman, a wonderful heart, incredible producer. She was one of our producers as well.
Okay.
And then throughout the whole film, you know, the Hawke kids are in the film, you know, in one place mm-hmm. or another. And it was really neat and an honor to be part of that.
Okay, that's awesome.
So, you know, and so, yeah, we dove in, practically speaking, we, you know, 2022 in the fall, prepped and we filmed January to February 2023 and then went in post-production and hit the festival circuit and were blessed to be in Telluride and Toronto and Zurich and Stockholm with the film. And And yeah, now so we're, now we're getting ready for the launch in May.
What now? I'm sure you know, you at least you have a little bit of insight into this. But if I were to interview Ethan, I would always say, you know, were you ever Catholic? Were you raised Catholic? You know, how do you know about Flannery? Because obviously he has a great knowledge of her work. Did you ever talk to him about what made him want to do it?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of, it really was how passionate Maya was about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then just getting to know Ethan, he is one deep dude. You know, like he is one. His mind is amazing. He is an amazing philosopher. The way he thinks about life, the way he thinks about characters, his passion for that. You know, like watching him, and I know there's something special and unique about Wildcat because of Maya. And I mean, you look at the people he brought, the acting core we have in it are just friends of his.
And Laura Linney.
Yeah. Ethan and Laura grew up together on stage and they, mm-hmm. you know, but just the conversations and doing Q&As with him and watching him respond. I don't know if I've ever seen him say the same thing twice to an answer, but everything is deep and profound, you know, and he loves. And you'll see this, like his previous biopic was on this country singer from Austin, Texas.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I seen that. Blaze?
Yeah, Blaze. Yep. And then mm-hmm. during COVID, he brilliantly did the documentary on Paul Newman and his wife Joanne.
That's right.
And so I mean Ethan he seems like he has this real deep fascination for character and people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love watching him in action. I love being in conversation with him. And I'll tell you what, I'm sure he looked at Flannery and after reading her writings and understanding and just, you know, just wanting to dive deep. You know, Ethan was, I believe he was baptized Catholic. I think his parents divorced when he was early and he was raised in the Episcopal Church.
Mm.
And so we talked about things growing up as, you know, our growing up as kids, being in youth ministry, going on mission trips.
Yeah.
Very spiritually minded. I had the gift of being able to produce and help coordinate the landing of really paying attention to all the Catholic elements in the film,
mm-hmm.
making sure we do Catholic right in the film, because a lot of times it's not done right. Finding, you know, we had just an open door from Archbishop Fobb in Louisville for the parishes and the churches we used and scouting those locations. And I loved watching Ethan because he's such an artist with such a creative mind. And we would walk in these spaces, and one of the churches that we used was built in the late 1700s, just an old Catholic church with the original Stations of the Cross and the original altar. And to watch and just to observe Ethan just absorbing it and taking it in and being in awe of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've learned a ton from him.
Yeah.
I think it's just, I think it was a perfect collision of a lot of things for him.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about one of my favorite scenes without giving too much away, but I think probably the most heartfelt scene for me was the scene between Maya Hawke and Liam Neeson, who's playing a local priest. And I think that conversation about suffering is really like at the heart, I think, of the film, because you know it's a biographical picture about Flannery O'Connor, you know, with elements of her short stories being thrown in there. But Flannery O'Connor was suffering; she was sick, and one of the lines that she said to the priest, played by Liam Neeson, was she says, "Lord, I don't want to be lonely, but she said, for sure, but boy, I sure do feel lonely when people only talk about you," or something like that. And I said, wow, that hit me. That hit me pretty deep. And when you watch the film, you can kind of understand that loneliness that she's feeling.
That's right.
But she lives for Christ. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
You know, she says that she wants to be a writer, and you know, she feels a little guilty because she thinks her stories are too scandalous and people aren't going to like them because of that. And Liam Neeson,
I don't want to be clever, but I do want to be clever.
Right.
Know?
And then he says, well, are they true? Like, are you speaking the truth? And she says, yes, I am. And he says, then write.
Then use that gift.
Right. And I thought it was great because, you know, for Catholics like me who came back into the faith, and when we dive back in, you know, I'm on fire zealously. So when she says something, are you here to give me or to grant me extreme unction or something? I think she said something along those lines. I'm like, that's cool. a lot of non-Catholics won't know what that is, but for us, it's, right. it's really cool. You know, she has a rosary. She's praying the rosary in the film a bunch of times. And I think a lot of the younger audience, when they see images like that,
right.
they say, okay, this is now becoming, I see Maya Hawke, who's in Stranger Things, you know, she's in probably one of the most, you know, prominent shows of the 21st century. And now right. there's this actress who's carrying a rosary and praying the rosary in a film. I think it might relate very strongly to them. So I really did appreciate this film. And I know we don't have too much time, but can you talk a little bit about the festival circuit? You know, for people who don't know, you know, how is that? What is it like? Is it there to showcase the film for a lot of critics, for a lot of people? And it's also used as a method of selling one's film to either a distributor, or to a studio. Yes. So what's the film festival circuit
yeah.
like?
Yeah, it was fun. It was a treat. And yes to all. I mean, you nailed it. It's for all of those, all of the above, right? So, you know, and Ethan is, again, it's just, you know, our quarterback, our champion. He's so beloved in the industry. He's a beloved son of the industry.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That's favor. You know, there's just, and it's so well earned. I mean, it's just who he is. Like, he's so authentic. And you feel like the film you're working on with him right now is the best thing he ever did in the world, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, getting accepted into the film festivals, you know, it was wonderful. The first one being Telluride, you know, and I believe there were 40 plus films in that out of probably 8,000 submissions. They're different. The Telluride's really neat. That one really is about, the filmmaker. So, mm-hmm. Is very low key.
Yeah.
The filmmakers, the actors, the talent, they show up in their jeans and they're there to just to be with each other and talk about each other's films. And it was a wonderful time. It was the first place to introduce, it was the first place we showed it, you know, publicly. Mm-hmm. And, speaking of Liam Neeson, we had to keep that a secret, not anymore, but we had to keep it a secret.
Yeah.
So nobody knew, even when we were at Telluride. So it was so fun. That particular scene, Mike, you just talked about, which is, by the way, my favorite scene because it's so pivotal.
Mm-hmm.
Liam Neeson showed up in that scene. You could hear the gasping in the
audience. Yeah. You know,
it was awesome. But no, the festivals are wonderful. That one really is more for the filmmaker, but you've got plenty of buyer, you know, the buyers are there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Toronto, Toronto's a bit different.
That's a big one.
It's a big one. I mean, the three big ones in the world that are all about selling your film are Cannes, Toronto,
and Sundance. Yeah.
That's right. And so that one, it's a different bird. And Toronto and Telluride are two very different cities, you know?
Right, right.
So a lot more press, red carpet, and then we're literally filling a theater with journalists and distributors, you know,
right,
to watch
right.
the film. It was an interesting moment, right? Because we were trying to sell our film in the heart of two strikes that are happening.
Yeah,
you know, and that absolutely impacted across the board the sale of films. Toronto, as an example, say there's 50 main films. Usually by a week after the festival, if not before, 70%+ of those films are sold.
Right.
So you have 50 films, 35 are gone. This year, 6 films sold.
Really?
6 films, 11%. Because the studios did not want to make agreements when they didn't know what they were getting into before the strike was settled, you know? And so that had an impact on a lot of films and a lot of filmmakers for sure. Then we were also in Zurich. So we had our world premiere at Telluride, our international premiere at Toronto, our European premiere in Zurich.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go to that one. Ethan and Ryan and Maya, I believe, or Ethan and Ryan, and then in Stockholm, Sweden. Stockholm was a good festival. I wasn't there. It was Ethan and Maya. And, you know, they're all different. And when we look at this film, I think there's 4 unique audiences that, you know, we're really grateful. We're our distributor domestically is Oscilloscope Laboratories,
mm-hmm.
Oscope and Radiant Films internationally. So we did come to agreements, which is great. And they're doing such a great job on the domestic side. But the Stockholm one was good because we sold out our screening and they opened it up and they sold that one out too. And more than 50% of the participants of both those screenings were young adult women 25 or under.
Oh, wow. Oh, great.
Who came to see Maya.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, you look at the audiences that we're looking at are certainly our Catholics who love Flannery, art house film lovers, literary world, the public, Flannery's publisher, FS&G, watched the film, loved it, getting behind it, doing book signing and our book reading events with Ethan and that. And then Maya's audience. And that's the one that fascinates me the most because this is, as you said, this is such a different role than Stranger Things or Do Revenge or the things her core knows her as.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
She's got 10 million Instagram followers.
And the fact that, you know, you said that she's pretty much the spark for the film. You know what I mean? So not only just her image drawing people in, but her desire to want to make a film about one of her favorite writers.
Yeah.
It's got to be something.
That's the audience. I'm so proud of her. I think it was a marvelous talent, and she did something she was super passionate about, and took a lot of risks and prepared. I think I heard on Halloween before we shot, she dressed in her full Flannery regale, and as kids came to the door, she was speaking in her Southern accent and working it out and practicing and she's wonderful, incredible. So that, you know, I'm excited for her audience to see the film. But yeah, bouncing around to all the festivals does the variety of things, of just a lot of getting the word out about the film, highlighting the film, wanting to get the film sold, pushing it through those avenues, getting the press aware. We got a lot of really great early press because of Telluride. And a lot of reviews. The reviews are lean right now, but some really important reviewers, when we get the LA Times saying it's a must see, those are really helpful reviews.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
No, and so yeah.
Okay. Well, it's in I know we got to wrap this up, but if there was any message to an audience out there that you want to get them to come see the movie, what can you tell us about the movie that, would want to draw people in, that you'd want to get them in the seats for?
That's a really good question. I think, what did Flannery say? She said, for the hard of hearing, you shout, and for the almost blind, you draw large and startling figures. And I think about where are we in our lives, right? Like there, walk in life. And I think that, the way she wrote was she was paying attention to her culture and all people living in all different ways and all different experiences. And all of her stories are always like the action of grace on a particular character, right? So the action of grace. And usually they're the action of grace on a character that is really not willing to support the grace, and it goes, and I think about that scene that you brought up, Mike, where Liam, Father Flynn, says that grace cuts like a sword before it heals. And so I would say, like, what I want people to come, when they come to the film, I want them to see a very human young woman who was very much faced with her own mortality, her own pain, her own suffering, initially saw having to be, almost, I don't mean this in a negative way, but kind of imprisoned in her home, that's where she lived out her 14 years after she was diagnosed. And she initially saw that as a death sentence, but she saw that it was life, and she could write and she could tell her stories. So I think I want people to relate to the struggles and the difficulties of the person of Flannery and the honesty in her writing, and to see that, to receive the experience, to relate to it as something that we're all called, that that grace is constantly being poured out into our lives.
Mm-hmm.
More often than not, it's probably not coming at us in a really nice box with a very pretty bow.
Yeah.
That all the moments of life are filled with grace. So wherever we're at in our life, wherever, whatever we're struggling with, whatever we're experiencing, to know, and I think she's a great example of it, that that beauty can come from the brokenness in our lives.
Oh, 100%.
And that God is always pursuing us, and always, even in the painful moments, God's grace is there. In the joyful moments, God's grace is there. And so, you know, I want people to see somebody who's very real, who's very important, who is living exactly what she was writing about. You saw the film, Mike. The reason why we use the device and put Maya in multiple characters and Laura in multiple characters is because Flannery was constantly putting herself in her stories.
Right.
Things that she struggled with, things that she was learning about herself. So I think, you know, ultimately, I think, as I said, I think for people to come and you know, experience a young woman who was very honest about the reality she lived in personally and the reality of her culture around her.
Yeah. I think also the film could probably be used as a good justification for beatification of Flannery O'Connor. I think that'd be kind of awesome.
Yeah. And yeah. I'm not going to give it away, but you saw that one scene outside of Cal's house, right?
Which one?
The scene where she's going to the party.
Yes.
And you make some comments to your point there.
Right. Exactly. Where that's what I said. She says, no, wouldn't, I don't remember what she said exactly, but wouldn't she feel that, I think, like, her characters would be offended if they didn't speak that way or something like that? Or the real people who would be offended if I changed their language or something like
that. That's right. It would be propaganda on the side of angels, you know?
That's right. Yes, yes.
Because, like, I'm being honest. This is how they wouldn't think about talking in any other way, you know?
Right.
So,
That line is propaganda. Again, really clever writing. With Ethan Hawke. And I've always wondered, you know, how people who write about real historical figures, how they write dialogue, just simple conversational dialogue. They have to put themselves in that person's frame of mind, or, you know, if there's probably not too much video about Flannery that existed, but, you know, you've got to write convincing dialogue.
That's right.
And they did that. And I thought it was awesome.
Ethan and Shelby Gaines co-wrote. Mm-hmm. Shelby also, and his brother Latham also did the score, which was amazing. They absorbed and read everything, and you can see it. But I'll tell you, here's a suggestion, you know, on the record, off the record, however you want it to be. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful conversation with Father Damien Ference, who is the vicar for evangelization in the Diocese of Cleveland.
Okay.
And he wrote a book that's published by Word on Fire called Understanding the Hillbilly Thomist.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
And I had a conversation with him the other day, and we're doing an event together in Cleveland as we open the film in June there. And it was just the most profound. I had never talked with somebody who knew Flannery so well. And it made me feel so good, because he was just dissecting every moment of the film. And I had learned more. I had seen how Ethan and our writer, Ethan and Shelby, just the brilliance of how they put Flannery into the story was there.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. It's awesome. Well, I mean, everybody listening, go and see Wildcat when you can. I believe it opens. When does it open domestically? In June or May?
May 3rd. Yep. In major cities. Right now we're in about 65, almost 70 cities. It's going to grow. It'll grow to hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of May is we're doing, you know, 15, 20 events, and Ethan is doing Q&A at every event.
Right.
And it's amazing. And then that'll launch us into what's to come. So, yeah.
I think there's one in Nashville or Franklin coming up. And, you know, if you're there, it'd be awesome to see you.
Belcourt on May 8th.
I will be there.
Ethan will be there.
Okay.
He'll do question and answer after the film.
That's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And listen, I don't say this dismissively, but this is an awesome little film. And when I say little film, I mean that in a way that there's such intimacy around the making of it. Like, you can tell it's not this huge mainstream blockbuster type of vibe where just a lot of money thrown behind it to promote it. But It's a really, really good little film. And I think that's one of the best things that I can say about a movie.
Thanks, Mike.
Good little film. But yeah, stick around for Don't Leave the Studio Quite Yet, because it's got to download some audio. But thank you very much to Eric Groth. And go see his film Wildcat. It's awesome. Thanks, Eric.